to see some serious shit.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a very special edition of Movie Moan for two reasons. One is that I've seen Skyfall, and I will be bringing you my first spoiler-free review in a format you've never seen on this show before. The second is that we have finally been able to bring back a special guest after an absence of several months. Will you please welcome filmmaker, producer, and special features magician currently working on the Blu-ray releases for Star Trek The Next Generation, the documentary on the creation of the He-Man toy line Toy Masters, and the now-titled reimagining of Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future, Phoenix Rising, Mr. Roger Lay Jr. Hello, sir.
How are you, Phil? How are you guys? It's a pretty good intro, Phil. I feel like I'm going to... Oh, I feel very special now.
Weep. I that's not enough. You must weep.
I don't know if I can live up to that.
Oh, no, it'll be fine, sir. I'm just excited. I'm so over the moon to finally be able to... Roger is a busy man, as you can imagine from that little CV I just listed off. The fact that we've been able to corner him and kidnap him literally for an hour or two is just amazing. So thank you so much for your time, sir.
It's my pleasure, and I am very jealous of you and Rob Burnett and Charlie Lauserica and all of you guys who were in London this weekend watching Skyfall.
Those fuckers.
Sam, each and every one of you.
Also joining us is the guy who, he should have been in the UK with me to see Skyfall, but instead of, not waiting the extra 2 weeks like a schmuck, he is a slave to the economy of Louisiana. He's a public servant, he is Mr. Jamie Williams, and he's very, very miserable.
I am happy for you guys. That's, you know what, Roger and I talked about this off air, it's like, yeah, well, some of us have to work for a living.
Uh-huh. I believe it was me who said that, sir. I am fully aware of the irony on this issue. I haven't had a day off since the start of August,
That's true, actually. You have busted your ass, like, just in general. I mean, I know the details, so it's, God bless you.
Well, let's get to it, folks. Before we have our in-depth interview with Roger and we talk about some news and stuff, for the very first time in Movie Moan history, I am honoured and delighted to say that I am coming to you from London in the flesh for our first review of Skyfall. And as you just heard, I am not alone.
Someone else.
I need to ponder.
Unless you would like the bridal suite.
I'm sorry, sir. That's all we have available, except the bridal suite.
Well, let's have a look at it. I may like it.
The porter will show it to you. He will be up immediately.
He's a pervert. Call the police.
My name's G. You know the rest. And welcome to a very special review from Movie Moan. It hardly seems like we're breaking new ground in the field of podcasts, by me just being on camera talking to you, but in another way, it is. You've never seen me before. We've never done it quite like this. But this is no ordinary review. This is very, very special. It actually goes back a few months. For those of you who are regular listeners and watchers of our show, you'll know that we had on our special guest, writer, producer, director, special features maestro, Mr. Robert Meyer-Burnett. He's often in my dreams. Jamie Williams, my podcast partner in crime, found Robert just bullshitting on Twitter, something which I don't do, unfortunately. And it's Jamie who I have to thank, because he got Robert on our show. We were talking on Skype for a completely different reason. We were doing a completely different show, nothing to do with James Bond, but it came quite clear within 5 minutes of talking to Robert that he was and is the biggest James Bond fan on the planet. There's no question of this, and you know how I can prove it? He found out that the 23rd James Bond film, or the third James Bond film, as Jamie likes to call it because it's a new series, Skyfall, opens in the UK 2 weeks before the States. And as soon as Robert heard that, he booked himself a trip to London for a week, just so he could beat the rest of his young buddies to the punch. Right now, it is Thursday, October 25th. Skyfall opens in the UK in about 9 hours, or something like that. And I'm going to see it with Robert tomorrow. I mean, we were just talking on Skype. He said he was coming over, and he just said, "Hey, Phil, come too." Alright, fine. So, we've got tickets booked for the 10:30 a.m. Show tomorrow at the Odeon Leicester Square. He said he's got tickets booked for the 5 p.m. show as well, and I've got tickets for the 9 p.m. show at the BFI IMAX, the biggest screen in the UK, because this is the first James Bond film in IMAX, and it's about bloody time, if you ask me. So it's going to be a pretty fucking cool day. The only thing I don't know at the moment is whether we're going to actually be able to record any of this as it's happening, because I thought basically that this is such a special event that it should be recorded just for my own memories, just for prosperity. The way it stands right now, Skyfall could be the best James Bond film ever that we've seen, period, the end. And if that's true, then I want to remember how I felt when I saw it. So I just bought a little Sony Handycam. I'm going to film some stuff, not in the theatre, obviously, because I'll get thrown out. And I'm just hoping that I'm going to be able to record a review as it happened right here in London with Mr. Robert Meyer-Burnett. He hasn't technically agreed to this yet, and you'll soon know if it doesn't work out, because if he says no, then it'll just be me giving you the review right here in this hotel room. But regardless, it's going to be an amazing day tomorrow, and let's find out how it turns out. So, as I was saying yesterday, if Robert didn't agree to anything, I'd be just doing the review in my hotel room. As you can see, we are here in Leicester Square. You can't tell it's Leicester Square right now, but when we go around the corner, you will. But I am going to give Robert his bribe for being on my show. I brought him gifts.
I love that. So I love being bribed.
So what I have got you, as promised, sir, first of all, is the 007 Smelly Set.
Oh.
You have aftershave, a shower gel and deodorant.
Wow.
Cost about £20.
This, now, come on. Now I'm a real man. Right here.
They will be.
Wow. I don't know what to say, Phil.
Just 5 minutes in the bathroom, in the cinema, and you're good to go.
Wow. I don't know what to say. This is 00 awesome. Fantastic.
They're not a sponsor, by the way. I know it looks like it right now, but they're not a sponsor. Available at Harrods. And also, I've also brought Robert's, out of my private collection, a copy of the 007 magazine, the Timothy Dalton retrospective issue, giving the man the credit he is due, finally.
Wow, and look at that cover. I've actually never seen this photograph before. That is a very fine photo. And this is obviously, judging from the hair, this is a License to Kill photo. This had to have been done License to Kill.
As we were saying yesterday, Robert is the biggest James Bond fan on the planet. There is no question. He can identify a film by the actor's hair, something I cannot do.
His bad side was a dangerous place to hang. That'll be Adeline for
July 89. There is also, even though you don't like the film, Robert doesn't like License to Kill, but there was a very interesting article in the back about the UK censor cuts to the film. And that huge battle it went through. It is an absolutely fantastic article. You will have to get this on eBay. It's not available in the shops, I'm afraid, but if you get a hold of this, it's absolutely fantastic. Tribute to John Barry, because The Living Daylights was his last film. Article on that. That's yours to keep forever.
I don't know what to say. It's only my second time in Blighty. Thanks, man.
You are welcome, sir.
Thank you so much. Okay. And now, around the corner, go to Cisco.
Before Skyfall, this is Robert Fibonet after Skyfall.
I need to ponder. I need to think about it.
It's waiting for you, Sponsor the Chewy.
We went to the first show. This is the next one.
The one we were in, the wrong empty seats at the front.
Yeah.
So maybe people watch it because they couldn't get time.
There's Bond with his chronic back pain.
Kind of a movie. Yeah. It seemed like it was made in 1975 by William Friedkin. Personal Bond.
It's the most beautiful looking Bond film ever.
Oh, the seats in Scotland were amazing.
I want to go there.
Ice King.
It's incredible. I
really love it.
I mean, it's right. You're on Sky News now. What did you say?
I just said it was good. No, I thought it was fantastic. Yeah.
And you're not a hardcore Bond fan to start with.
No, but I think it was probably one of the most well-balanced Bonds I've seen, actually. I think it did everything.
It hit all the buttons for me, so.
Yeah.
And I'm not a crazy Bond fan, so I don't follow it all the way through, but.
Yeah.
I like this one.
Yeah.
After being kind of off some of the other great photos, I like that.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not an action film.
No.
It's very, very different.
I would just like to say, it's a quiet film, which this film is great, except when there's excessive coughing in the audience. Really, really bothersome.
Do you know what I think it is? I think Sam Mendes has an amazing way of creating space, and you can just stop time. And
it's constant.
You know, he just creates the space.
Yeah, enjoy the Rams game.
That's
so fun.
And a lot of space. He really went on the story with it, whereas I think the others sometimes trying to get too much in, and you come out and you're a bit exhausted. Whereas I think.
How you doing? I'm Rob Burnett. Brian to meet you. Did you enjoy the
film?
We've just done our second viewing of Skyfall. We're in the theatre right now. I might get thrown out, but I don't care. You feeling okay, Robert?
Yeah, I figured it out. This film is the Unforgiven of the Bond franchise. As you said, it's a thriller. It's not an action film. It's deliberately paced. It's mannered. And it has a lot more intellect and pathos going on than the standard Bond film. I think it transcends the Bond genre, and Bond in itself is a genre. And this transcends that genre in every way, shape, and form. This Bond marks the end of one era and the beginning of another. I don't know what that new era is going to be. It can either go back to the old way, or it can advance. rise and evolve, not unlike V'ger. Picture. So, after seeing it the second time, I feel very fulfilled.
Oh, sorry folks, music's getting a little dramatic. We'll be right back. Basically, going off the way this film ends, do you think this would have been the perfect ending for Craig's tenure, or are you over the moon that he is doing two more?
No, I think it's great that he's doing two more, but I hope that it seems like, Charlie was saying earlier, it's almost like it's a reboot. Like they've put things back to the way they were, and I hope that's not the case. I hope they travel like this film did into, they break new ground that we haven't seen before, because I wouldn't want to go back to the same Bond tropes that we've seen. I think this is a much more intelligent film, it's a much more adult movie, and while it might not tickle that Bond fancy with big climaxes with battling armies in the bowels of oil tankers, but it's a whole new thing, and it's grown up and matured, and I would like to see that continue. What began with Casino Royale was definitely, the promise of Casino Royale was paid off with this film, and I would like to see that continue with the franchise.
I don't think this is a problem. I can't add anything. He's too good. He's too good at this. But I mean, I think we'll never see a film like this again.
No, I don't think so. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, I would not want to be the next director to take on this franchise, because Mendez was able to get that cast. Well, that came to work for him.
I was going to ask that question actually, because I think it could very well be Danny Boyle. Danny Boyle, for those of you who don't know, directed the Olympic spot with the Queen jumping out the helicopter. And, you know, maybe it's, I'm drawing too much into it to think he might do the next one, but after you've done Sam Mendes, you can't then just have anybody.
No, yeah, I would like to see this begin a trend of Academy Award-winning directors taking on the Bond franchise.
Yes.
And Danny Boyle, I think, is a fine choice. But, oh my God, Roger Deakins. He knocked it out of the park.
Star of the film.
Unbelievable.
I think a nomination's in order.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a couple. I think this Bond film might be the most nominated Bond by the Academy that we've ever seen, which, well-deserved. Well-deserved.
Well, here comes the cliche question. Best scene and least favorite scene.
Oh, I didn't have a least favorite thing. I think the scene in Shanghai, and I don't want to say what happens in Shanghai, was a tour de force of direction and cinematography and action choreography. Amazing. I love the scene when he first met Severine. She was amazing. It's too bad. And I thought the whole end of the film, a lot of people have talked about they didn't like, I love the end. I love the whole end that takes place at Skyfall. I'll let you guys find out what that is, but I loved it. I love the whole thing. So, of a piece, it really is the Unforgiven of the Bond franchise.
The mob ascends. Let's watch the magic.
I made this post about Skyfall, 5 minutes ago?
How many comments?
Nine people commented on it already.
Jesus Christ.
I imagine they were all tell me everything, right?
No, it's interesting because
people don't want to know.
Has Jamie come back to you yet?
No.
No, I figured so.
He might have on Twitter. Because it is noon.
That's right.
So the only thing that I found really upsetting is that Ralph Fiennes is now fat, ugly, and old.
Come on!
I used to be so in love with him.
Because he was the man in Strange Days and The English Patient. In The English Patient, he's like Mickey Rourke was in 9.5 weeks.
I fell in love with him actually in Cusho.
Oh, that's a great Cusho.
I wanted to marry him in Cusho. Now,
come on, man, he can still do no wrong.
He's repellent.
Oh, what?
I mean, he was a good actor, but he's just so ugly.
Oh, man, Ralph Fiennes, he's Lenny Nero, man.
Big nose, horrible receding hairline.
Oh, it happens to all of us.
Kind of pasty.
Come on.
Blonde.
No.
You thought the fights in the film were good? Let's watch this one.
Come on, Ralph Fiennes could do no wrong.
Absolutely.
He started The English Patient.
15 years ago, he could do no wrong.
And now he's got a long-time job.
Now he's directed Coriolanus. Come on.
That's true.
He's the man.
He's the man.
He's always the man. He will always be the man.
Well done, Ray.
He was the man, he is the man, he will always be the man.
No, he's not.
All hail Ray Fiennes. And can we get a Strange Days Blu-ray except in Germany? It's out on Blu-ray in Germany, but not in the States. Why is that?
I have no control over these things, but I'll see what I can.
Box Home Video, where's Strange Days? Directed by Catherine Bigelow. Fun in the Catherine.
Who?
You
know,
Catherine,
who?
They should do a Catherine Bigelow.
Why do I not have... Why do I have to go to Germany? And by the way, it's not region-free. I can't play in the States. I don't have a region-free Blu-ray player. Right? I really want Strange Days on Blu-ray. Why don't I have it? I don't have the right stuff, but next year I understand.
You don't have a region-free player in your edit suite?
I don't. Not
what
Blu-ray.
What kind of edit suite are you working on?
I'm off to the IMAX now. The others can't come. Well, Robert can't come with me. He's got dinner with friends. He can't. So, but I bought 9 tickets, so I think I have a row to myself, which is nice, and lots of people glaring and at me for taking the tickets. But I'll sell them to some people on the streets if I can hawk them off. Well, that was a good day. That was seriously one of the best days I've had in a long, long time. We didn't get to record, obviously, a full hour-long review in the middle of Leicester Square with Robert, but we got his initial thoughts on the film, and we're going to have him back to do the spoiler-filled version in a couple of weeks' time when you've all had the chance to see it. But, I mean, I think he summed it up pretty well, and I've got a couple of extra thoughts of my own to add right now. Again, spoiler-free, or a spoiler-free as I possibly can make it.
The most important thing to say about Skyfall is adjust your expectations. Now, don't panic. The movie's fantastic. I loved it. We loved it. We loved it even more the second time. The pacing was better the second time, and we weren't focused on what the movie wasn't as opposed to what the movie was. The first time we saw it, we were so shocked by how much of a thriller it is as opposed to an action film. If you go into it with the mindset that it is a chase, tense, psychological thriller, then I think you're gonna have no problems and you're gonna enjoy it more. But just don't think it's the traditional Bond film with a 2-hour travelogue and action sequences which stop the film dead for 10 minutes. It's not that kind of film at all. And because of that, I think there is gonna be a bit of a division on the film. Some of the critical raves you've heard are a bit overblown. It's not the best James Bond film, and it's not as good as Casino Royale, so it's not even Craig's best outing. I can promise you, not everyone is going to like Skyfall. Even though we've had Bond films with personal stakes before, Skyfall is the most intimate Bond film that's ever been made. It's surprisingly small scale. It's got scope, it's got action, it's got money on the screen, but the plot is really just about protecting or destroying one woman. It's really, when you boil it down, only one person's life at stake. The Bond girl in this film is Judi Dench. The other Bond girls, even though they have sizable screen time and definite charisma and personality, and Naomi Harris and Berenice Marlowe are fantastic in it, they only have smaller roles in comparison to Judi Dench. She is the character that spends the most time with Daniel Craig's Bond. Now, to be fair, the film's first hour takes us on the usual globe-trotting travelogue. We go from Turkey to Shanghai to Macau to the villain's evil island lair in God knows where. But the second hour takes us back to Blighty and keeps us there. It's not a fantastical story at all this time. There is no fantasy in Skyfall. Even the Nolan Batman films, for all their grounding, they do take place in a slightly elevated plane from our own. It's not the real world. Skyfall is the real world. The intention very much seems to be that while you're in the theatre watching this film, this story could be happening just outside right now. And that's especially effective if you see the film in London like we did, because so much of it takes place there. For example, there's a major set piece at the London Underground on a platform that I passed by while I was coming to the theatre. It's all part of the plot, though. This is the first Bond film that deals with the information age, the functionality of espionage in that world where everybody knows anything, in the world where we have WikiLeaks, where nobody has secrets anymore, where there are no shadows, which is a direct line from the film. As I'm sure you're aware, the film kicks off with the greatest internal British intelligence security breach in history, certainly the history of this series of films. M's capability of leading British intelligence into this new era is called into question. She's put on trial, essentially, as is the entire old way of doing spying. In one particular sequence, M making a statement to the Judicial Committee is called upon on her own to basically defend the old way of spying on people, of defending our country, of espionage as we've known it for the previous 50 years of Bond films. And she defends it and does it while Bond is chasing his enemy, and while we're seeing that classic Bond style action and chasing. It's brilliant, but of course, as you can imagine, you know, it's not an action sequence which is just stopping the film dead. We're having tense psychological discussions and sequences, poetic dialogue scenes, intercut with action. So you can't call it an action film. It's a thriller. That word tension keeps coming up a lot. There is so much angst and tension in the film that, combined with the realism I was speaking of, there's nothing to transport you, to lift you out of your own mundane life. And a lot of people count on the Bond films for that. It's not escapism. The other thing that's important to note is that it is a film that has managed to keep most of its story and its surprises a secret till release. I know a lot of you think, from watching the full-length trailer, that you've seen the film. You haven't. Trust me, it's misdirection. That basically gives you the setup for the film and how the first hour plays, but that tells you nothing about what happens, especially in the third act. But if you're going to keep a plot like this top secret, literally until the moment that you sit in the theatre as an audience member and see it, then you better have something pretty mind-blowing for that to work. Sometimes it backfires. Now, I think that Skyfall has a cracking story, but it is, in a lot of ways, predictable. If you're a fan, you've already figured out the twists. Also, the plot itself, if you really hold it up to scrutiny, doesn't make a lot of sense. Unfortunately, I can't really talk about that until we do the spoiler-filled review, but trust me, we had a conversation outside once we'd seen the film, and there's one particular bit where we said, "Wait a minute, that whole 5 minutes didn't make sense," and it didn't. And the other critical issue that I think is going to split people, maybe right down the middle, is that the future of the Daniel Craig Bond film series, for the foreseeable future, has been irrevocably changed. It's been put on a path and packaged into a formula that maybe not everybody's going to be comfortable with. You have to admire the balls on the filmmakers and the producers for making changes. And by the end of this film, definite changes have been made that they can't retcon. But I absolutely loved the film because it directly addresses one of the great mysteries of James Bond, and yet one of the things that to me makes him a hero, that he continues, no matter what, to serve Her Majesty's Secret Service. Every adventure, certainly in Craig's run, every agony, every torture, every death around each corner situation, it doesn't dissuade him. He comes back every time reporting to duty to an employer who will give him up in an instant because that's part of their job. And what makes that especially poignant in this film is, as you've seen from the trailer, Bond is officially killed in action. He no longer exists, and he can stay that way, off the grid, off the map, in peace and tranquility, and alive for the rest of his life. But he doesn't. The moment that he finds out that MI6 is under attack and M is being targeted, he comes back. I am going to spoil that Bond returns to London, not 10-15 minutes after getting shot and drowned. And I initially thought that they were rushing that because there is a lot that you could do with Bond being off the grid, but they're making a point in the story. Having Bond come back into service so quickly makes that point about this man's sense of duty, not just to MI6 of course, but to this one woman who in this run of films has had a particularly significant bond. In Judi Dench's M, in this film especially, the filmmakers actually have the courage to make her not necessarily likeable, we like her because we know that Bond likes her, but she is a person bound by duty. She knows what that entails. She knows that at any moment she might have to give one of her agents up, and it doesn't matter how paternal she is about them, and that sense of her having paternal feelings, of her being a mother to her agents, her children, who, as we find out in this film, are in many cases orphans that she picked from a very young age. She's been at this game for longer than we could possibly think. And that might not be the best way to run MI6, because as we find out here, you have people who will hold a grudge. On the flip side, you have someone like Bond who, no matter what, even when you are an inch away from death, is going to jump out of nowhere and possibly take a bullet for you. And what's great, without spoiling things really, is that eventually the role between Bond and M, between mother and son, switches. Eventually it is Bond who becomes very much the paternal character in that relationship. It's M who's filled with uncertainty and doubt, and finally that tough exterior cracks, and she has to ask Bond whether everything she's done was the right thing. She needs reassurance from the person who is now better and stronger than she is. And one final thing they do with Bond in this film, which is really great, is that they give him a physical injury which eats at him throughout the whole film. They'd actually done this before in The World Is Not Enough. He crash-landed on top of the Millennium Dome and he ended up with a shoulder injury. But if you actually watch that film back, it's only a problem for him whenever it's convenient for the film. Basically, whenever somebody presses down really hard on his shoulder, he'll go, "Ah, my shoulder." But apart from that, he's running and rolling and shooting, and there's nothing wrong with his aim either, which is just silly. In this film, Bond gets shrapnel in his innards, thanks to his injury at the start of the film, and he is a physical wreck. It's mentioned several times. He doesn't fall down and crumple to the ground, but he is out of shape. He can't do the usual fitness regime that is standard practice for a super secret spy. He can't aim. He can't shoot properly. James Bond misses. It's also a great way of showing how suicidally reckless Bond can be sometimes, that he is so devoted to the mission that he will sometimes just leap into a situation completely forgetting about his state of physical health. There's one particularly awesome bit where he jumps on an elevator and then immediately realizes he should have known better, because only one of his arms has the strength to actually hold him onto it. Luckily, he doesn't actually have to fight too much in this film. There really aren't too many fisticuff fights. And the villain, Silver, played by Javier Bardem, is not really a physical heavy. Yeah, if a lot of you were expecting this to be a real physical showdown between these two titans of acting and charisma, then you are going to be disappointed. Silver is not a physical heavy. He's a techno-terrorist. And he's absolutely nuts. You would mark the film as a traditional Bond film, and I'd say about a 7 out of 10 for the hour before he comes into the film. Once he comes in, the film goes right to a 10 for a period of about 5 minutes while he's making his introductory scene and his introductory speech, which tells us everything we need to know about the character. He is mesmerising. You cannot take your eyes off him. He really does have that Joker quality about him, which is the only comparison I would make to The Dark Knight, in that you have this amazing powerhouse of charisma in a villain that the audience immediately responds to. He's not scary, I would say, but he is absolutely hysterical. That introductory scene, I can promise you folks, it is immediately going to go down as one of the all-time classic Bond scenes. That much I can say. That is not hyperbole. He makes probably the best introduction to a Bond villain ever. I would say he is one of the best Bond villains ever, but really his character doesn't have the closure and the follow-through to his evil scheme that it really should. Can't talk about that, unfortunately, until we get into the nitty-gritty, spoiler-filled plot details. But what I will say for the moment is that casting Bardem was the move that elevated this film just from really good to damn, that's good. The actual idea behind Silver, as you've probably already heard, is that he is one of M's children, in a way, and one who holds a grudge, one that has been betrayed, and has very understandable motivations for doing what he's doing. His backstory is, in a lot of ways, very similar to Sean Bean's character in GoldenEye, Alec Trevelyan 006, who also basically came into the Secret Service under the pretense that he was fighting against a particular evil empire, a government, and that the accomplishment of his mission would be the eventual defeat of that empire, that this is why he'd signed on, this is why he was sacrificing his life every goddamn day for the accomplishment of this goal. But with the world being what it is, times change, treaties are signed, countries that were once at each other's throats in an instant can shake hands and become friends. And what happens to these people in the trenches, these spies? Are they just supposed to immediately go with the flow when they've sacrificed everything? The difference is that with Alec Trevelyan, he had a grudge basically against the entire British Empire. With Silver, it's very, very personal. M did something which was not cool. I won't tell you what it is, but Silver has every right to be angry and to want her blood. And the best thing about it is that actually he followed orders. Even when he was betrayed, he actually tries to kill himself, as all agents are supposed to when they end up in captivity. He actually did go through with that, and it didn't work. He was actually not even allowed to die, and he takes this very much as an act of fate, that he was meant to live because he had another purpose in life. There was something that he needed to do. He needed to get payback. Oh, and the final thing I'll say about Mr. Silver is that, just like all of the villains in Fleming's books who had a particular physical quirk or a deformity, he is no different. Just wait till you find out the issues that Mr. Silver has physically. It's one of the most jaw-dropping things that you'll see at the movies this year. It's icky, and it's going to get a great reaction from your audience, I can promise you. The characters of Mallory, played by Ralph Fiennes, and Eve, played by Naomi Harris, can't say anything about them really without blowing things, but all I'll say is that they're really, really good. And Mallory especially, Ralph Fiennes is third billed in the credits for a reason. It's not just some little cameo like Michael Madsen turning up for no reason in Die Another Day. He has a function in the plot. He has a fully rounded character, and he's great. Naomi Harris, I've heard some complaints about her, but honestly, she does what she needs to do. She's not in the film that much, but she has very sweet chemistry with Craig. You also have Albert Finney in a top secret role, which again, I just won't spoil at all. All I'll say is that he's absolutely fantastic and gives the film a shot in the arm when it needs it. He comes into the film in a point where we've been sitting with characters that we're very familiar with for a long time, and it'd be nice to see somebody new to shake things up. And we get Albert Finney, a masterclass actor, and it's really, really great. He's fantastic, and one of the funnier characters as well. His lines, one particular line, always brings the house down. And don't forget, I've seen it 3 times, laughed every time. Ben Whishaw as Q, not the irritable grump you might expect. Someone who has a very, very nice understated chemistry with Craig, and it's really, really great to see them here and see how that's going to continue in the future films. And then we also have the mysterious and beautiful Severine, played by Berenice Marlowe, who is basically a trapped woman, a kept woman who's working for Silver, and she has a backstory of her own, which Bond immediately sees based on just a tattoo on her arm. It's a very tragic backstory. Again, I'm not going to spoil it, but what is lovely about it, and it's in no way bluntly stated, but it seemed to me that Bond very much saw Vesper, his old love, in Severine. And one of the first things out of his mouth when he realises the trouble that Severine is in, and he says that, I can help you. I can get you out of this. Because I think very much that if Bond knew the trouble that Vesper was in right from the start, he would have done the same thing. The real tragedy about that relationship is he was too late to save her. the film is not just exquisitely acted, it's exquisitely crafted. As you probably already heard, and we said it before, Roger Deakins, director of cinematography on Skyfall, is the star of the show. There are shots in this film which, when you get the Blu-ray, you will immediately just want to freeze frame and stare at for 5 minutes. Even though these films do get made in less than a year, this film started shooting last November, you get the impression that there are shots here which they basically spent the entire day to get, just to get one shot, and it's so worth it. I really don't think that you need to see this one in IMAX, although it looks lovely there. Just see it in a great cinema with great production, and you will just drown in the beauty of this film. You really will. The score by Thomas Newman, it's a really damn good score. It saves the film. It is not going to the Bond theme pain reliever every time it needs to just, it's run out of ideas and it needs to play something. If a composer ever ran out of ideas in a previous film, they'd just go to the Bond theme. Newman doesn't do that. You only hear it sporadically when it's really needed. Stuart Baird, the masterclass editor from 100 action movies and from Casino Royale, is back in this film. And it really shows. The way that the action sequences and the chase sequences are cut together is just masterful. There's a really nice trick of basically using an action beat to cut to the next scene. So, for example, if a car is swerving around, that will immediately cut you to the next shot or cut you to the next scene. It's subtle, but it really, really works. The pace of this film is amazing. You don't notice it the first time, I have to say. The first time, you're so engrossed that you're really paying attention. So you are noticing the length because you are there in the film, probably not wanting it to end. The second time that we saw it, the pace increased dramatically. This film moves with a third act which has never been seen and will probably never be seen again in a Bond film, one which is just so different than what we're used to. There is a choice that is made in the finale, which, to be honest with you, if I really think about it, I am not a huge fan of, because I actually think that it, in a lot of ways, undermines what the whole film was about, and I did have a problem there. Of course, I can't talk about that at all. This is so frustrating. But what I will say is the final 5 minutes, which is now setting up the series as it's going to be, is just beautiful. If you're a fan, and this is all I'll say, if you're a fan of those older films and the way that those films used to be and the way that London used to be in those films in MI6, then you are going to have, I think you're going to get chills, nay, tears, when you see how this turns out. And as with any good Bond film, you want to see the next one right now. I want to see the next one right now. I am over the moon that Craig is going to do two more. As long as they're good, of course. If they're shit, then of course I'll say, oh, he never should have done two more. But for right now, it's just amazing what this, the legs that this series has, the longevity. I'll always say it, the great thing about the Bond series is that they know, as an audience now, in a world where we have movies with the scope and ambition that they do, being made by filmmakers intelligently, and movies with something to say, with powerful themes, that we won't accept the Bond film that you'd get from Roger or Sean in his later films, one which is not about anything, which is just about spectacle and fun. No, we expect something that is about the human condition, that is about Bond, that has things to say. And the fact that they can keep this going three films in, because I liked Quantum, it did try, it's got lots of problems, but it did try, it's amazing. As long as that continues, I am going to be right there. And of course, I'm really, really hoping that me and Robert can reunite for Bond 24 and give you another review right then. And hopefully it's only 2 years away, because seriously, I have marked a date in my calendar for October 26, 2014. Roll on, Bond 24. I give Skyfall an 8 out of 10. You'll understand exactly why it doesn't have the extra 2 points in a couple of weeks' time. But until that spoiler-filled review, seriously, you need to get out and see it, even just for the debate that you're going to have afterwards. We have never seen a Bond film as interesting as Skyfall. It's a treat. It's fantastic. Go and see it.
Happy birthday, Mr. Bond.
So we hope you enjoyed that, folks. I can't guarantee I'll be bringing you every review of mine that way. Look, if Robert could come over basically for every film I ever see from now on, then absolutely we would do it that way, but Roger's not having any of that. So,
no,
Roger...
It's not going to happen. I can't wait. I hate it. I'll say it. I hated Quantum of Solace. I despise it.
That's okay. That's fine.
Nothing wrong with it.
A lot of people, though, have a very specific idea what a James Bond film is, and that's where a lot of the criticisms will come in from, because Skyfall ain't your usual Bond film at all, and that's all I'll say about that.
Is it a good film? In your opinion, is it a good film?
It's a fantastic film. It's just not an action film. It's a thriller. It's an action thriller.
Well, here's my question to you, Phil. Casino Royale, one could argue, is not a traditional Bond movie either. I would argue,
and it works beautifully.
And it works, and that similar to Star Trek, that made people Bond fans who never were Bond fans. Like, I want to see that.
It's a little bit different with this one, because with Casino Royale, you still had escapism, you still had luxury locations. You were going to the Bahamas, you were going to the VIP room at the Casino Royale, places where regular Joes like ourselves can't go. Skyfall's not like that. You don't have that. And that's what Robert was saying, especially. He was missing the escapism of a Bond film. Skyfall takes place in the real world, not even a step away from it. It's the real world. This is all happening right now while you're sitting in the theatre. And it's different. I love that. I love the film, but definitely not everybody is going to. But it's the same with Star Trek.
As a Bond fan, I would argue we've seen the real world as depicted in 007 before. I mean, the greatest example is from Rush with Love. That is a straight-up 1963 set Cold War thriller.
And come on, Jamie, don't tell me Moonraker wasn't the real world. I mean, it doesn't get any more real than Moonraker.
It's out of this world!
It's Bond and beyond.
So that's why you love me.
Damn it!
No, I am actually excited about that. Because look, to me, if it's a good film, it's a good story. If the character is compelling, the journey is compelling, I'm in. And even if it doesn't have the mechanics of all the previous Bond films. Because to me, Quantum of Solace lost me. I felt that I wasn't engaged by it. There was all this convoluted stuff happening that I didn't feel was working. And even for me, that one, yeah, it had a couple of the things of the Bond movies, but it didn't seem as, I don't know, it just didn't seem as exciting and like you're saying, it didn't have that, I don't know, there was a lot missing for me when I saw Quantum.
Well, Charles said it best, actually. He said that the last one was just incredibly claustrophobic. This one is. This one breathes. It has room to tell its story. It's 140 goddamn minutes, and my god, does it move! But you've heard all of that in my review, folks.
I guess the other thing I want to ask is that since we're talking about Skyfall, the criticism of the two first films, and I say first films because it's a reboot, and when you say reboot, that means it's brand new. You're completely starting over. It's movie number one. So for the first two movies, everyone kept saying Bourne movie, Bourne movie, Bourne movie was the comparison. Whether or not you agree with that or not, I don't personally, but
I don't think so.
Is that a trap fall that they have fully avoided now with the third film, Phil?
You wouldn't even think of it that way. It's a ridiculous comparison as far as I'm concerned. Yes, in Quantum you can bring it up because of the editing style. Absolutely, I'll agree with that. With this one, you don't even think about it at all. It's about... it's a completely different character. The Bourne movies are about a guy who is returning to something, he doesn't know what, but he's trying to find an identity, trying to find a sense of purpose. You have a character in Bond who dies, that's not a spoiler, that's in the trailer, and comes back because he knows who he is, what he needs to do, he has that sense of duty, he's a hero. It's a completely different character. And also, by the way, let's be honest, if we're comparing Skyfall to the Bourne legacy, I think that's a knockout punch in the first 5 seconds. I mean, it just doesn't even compare.
So wait, so I've kind of stayed away on purpose on this one. Like, I keep telling Rob I don't want to know anything about it. I just want to go see it. So obviously, the Bond movies are very much, they're like, you know, they never pick up after the previous one. You know what I mean? Like, you could say Quantum of Solace did have some of that, but usually they never have that. So on this one, you're jumping in as if this is a first Bond movie, kind of like Casino Royale, or am I wrong here? Is that how it's, there's no threats is what I'm saying. There's no threats from the previous two, right?
No, and that's actually its greatest strength, because the relationship between Bond and M comes to the forefront and is so vital to this film. They don't actually use the other films as an excuse that you already know how it works between the two. They reestablish it. They tell you everything you need to know about that relationship for it to pay off, and it does, big time, for this film to work. I mean, me and Jamie have talked about it, but it really feels like they're following the template of the Connery films in there. You had Spectre as an overarching enemy in the first two, the way you had Quantum as an overarching enemy in Craig's two films. Then you took a break with Goldfinger, who had nothing to do with Spectre, and Javier Bardem has nothing to do with Quantum. I really feel with the next two that Quantum will be back in a big way.
But then, even though Quantum is not involved, in there's no elements of Quantum in this one.
No,
you're saying that they could do it on the next one and then keep that thread going? Because I thought this was like a reboot kind of thing where there's none of that mythology exists anymore. You know, you're cleaning the slate. I thought you were doing that. I thought they were doing that.
It feels like a reboot. It definitely does, and I can't really tell you how. You'll get it immediately when you see it, but they don't mention it at all, which means they can totally come back. I guess just the feeling I have is I don't want Quantum of Solace to be the end of Quantum, because I think it's a great idea, and they haven't fully delivered on the promise of that in that film. You know, there's more you can do with that. So that's the only reason. But definitely, for God's sake, the fact that you guys have to wait.
Rub it in.
No, I agree. The fact that you have to wait 2 weeks is absurd, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't really think it's that big a deal. I mean, and I've said this before, but let's be honest here. It's yours. James Bond is the UK, so it would be a disservice if you guys didn't get it first.
What's scary though about the way things function these days is that if I was the studio, I would have opened it day and date everywhere, because here's what's going to happen. You know that eventually, by now probably, there's really shitty video copies up on download services and things like that people in the U.S. are seeing, because they can't wait. You know, you have these obsessive guys who can't wait to see it and can't wait to know the story. So, you know, they'll look at that and in a way, it's like everything's so connected these days, and you can't just kind of think that holding a release date by 2 weeks in a specific territory is going to.
It's funny. I agree with you on that, sir. But here would be, and I think this is probably what Sony's thinking is. Hey, that happened with Avengers. They came out 2 weeks early, and it came out in America, and it was the biggest opening weekend of all time. It didn't hurt it one bit. And scenes got leaked all over YouTube. I think, Phil, you were telling me, like, there were moments, the big moments that everyone talks about in the Avengers, and there's a couple of them, they leaked on YouTube, and Disney didn't pull them. They just said, fuck it, let them stay. And it did.
Yeah, because in the end, this kind of movie, like, for me, I'll tell you from my point of view, I don't want to see it like that. I don't want to see it like that.
I don't either.
A gigantic screen. I want to see it in 7.1, hear it in 7.1, see it in a gigantic screen, IMAX, wherever it ends up being. But I want to experience that collectively with a fan audience, right. You know, and have that larger than life presentation. I don't want to see it on a little YouTube screen or download it and see a shitty handheld video camera or iPhone recording of it. That to me is not how you enjoy these films. So
it's one of these things where, I mean, if I'm right, the entire.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, if I'm right, the entire plot will now be on Wikipedia for Skyfall.
Yeah. I looked out of curiosity. I didn't read it. I just skimmed right through it. It said like plot overview, and like I skimmed through it. And it was pretty long. So I was like, all right, so the whole thing's already there.
I wouldn't read it. But look, you can argue that, you know, 20-some years ago, genre movies, you were getting the novelization out a month before the movie came out. You know,
that's
remember
right.
Empire? And again, it's up to you whether you're going to buy it and read it, or you're going to wait and have the big, explosive reaction to the full piece on the big screen. You know, I would wait. I wait. I wait. I don't. But again, like he's saying, you could go and read the outline on Wikipedia. You know,
I literally just booked my IMAX tickets as we were discussing, like, you know, all of this. I couldn't wait. Had to go and get them for midnight. That's the other thing. Actually, for people that listen there, if you're in America, it comes out on Thursday, a day early in IMAX. So they must be feeling something here, which, of course, that means there's midnight screening. So really, Wednesday night, you could see. Yeah,
Wednesday
and
night.
I'm going to the state capitol to see it Wednesday night.
He was saying we saw it the second time. It works even better the second time. That's not an excuse, of course, but I mean, the first time we were so surprised by what it wasn't as opposed to was the trailer. is not the film at all. It's just, it's a completely different tone.
That's great. I think that's a good thing.
Maybe,
that's the risk you take when you hire someone like that. I mean, that's where the Broccolis deserve a lot of credit, is that they did hire an auteur. They did listen to Daniel Craig's suggestions, which they did on the second one, to success or to failure. And it's a varied reaction. You know, Craig pushed for Mark Forster to get hired, and he pushed for Sam Mendes to get hired. And those were two very different kind of directors to direct a Bond movie. And we talked to this earlier about John Logan's now going to write two more. And they're going to try to make them as one big movie, a two-part film. That's the next. That to me is the next risk you take with Bond. And since clearly it's worked according to Phil and Robert and people who've seen it already, you know, bring it on. Let's try it. Let's do a two-part movie. Because remember, the books used to have cliffhangers, and you'd have to get the next book to find out what happened to Bond. And of course, Broccoli and Saltzman were like, we're not fucking doing that. Understandably, let's do that though. You know.
Well, let's talk about that, actually. I mean, we won't talk about any of the other news tonight. Actually, we'll leave that because we're running long, folks. But what we will talk about is that, it has just been announced that, and this is unofficial off the record at the moment, but John Logan, who co-wrote Skyfall with Neil Pearce and Robert Wade, who've been with the series since The World Is Not Enough, apparently Pearce and Wade are now leaving the series to pursue other projects, which completely blows Jamie's theory that they had blackmail photos of the Broccolis, which
I think they burned the pictures is what happened, Phil.
Oh, you're such a cynic. But anyway, they're leaving. So
so interesting. It's so interesting that a pair of writers has gone on to do all these films, and they've been yet so different, and there have been ones that have really worked really well and ones that have failed miserably, and they've come from the same writers. It's very interesting. I don't think that has happened that often in the industry. How many have they done? I mean, like 10 almost? Five. Six? Five?
I will say,
to give some credit, though, I remember the infamous Latina Review script review before Paul Haggis was hired to rewrite it, and El Mayi Bey over at Latina Review, he was very complimentary and said, this is a great script, that Wade and Purvis nailed it. So maybe you could say, well, that's Ian Fleming's source material talking. Yeah, but you still got to translate it. That's arguably a tougher job.
That first hour of the film is arguably theirs, and that's not the book at all.
It works. It absolutely works.
I mean, I think they're really, really good on, I've said this before, I think they're really good on plot and structure. Like, they get the skeletal structure sorted out of the story. And obviously, John Logan is a playwright, so he's obviously had a lot of contribution to the dialogue.
Don't forget John Logan gave the world Star Trek Nemesis.
So. I have forgotten
We haven't forgiven him for that one yet.
Well, he did also write Hugo, which is my favorite film of last year, so I'm kind of...
Gladiator.
But Logan, anyway, has apparently pitched a two-parter to the Broccolis, how the next two films are going to go, which, of course, would be Craig's last two films, and possibly even film them back-to-back. Now, here's what I'll say. I don't believe that they're going to film them back-to-back. I would certainly hope not. That is never good news to me because it very, very ever really works. You're first of all asking one director who, let's be honest, anytime you hire a director to do a Bond movie, it's always a risk. You don't know if it's going to turn out. So if you hire a director and you make a mistake, you're stuck
with
that director for two films.
Well,
and
you're stuck. If the first film doesn't work, you're stuck with the second part.
That's
much,
true,
you know?
Too, and that's the risky part. But at the
and
same
again, with Bond, I love the idea that even though you're saying now this, there's a bit of a reinvention here now and it could go in a different direction, I like the idea that the Bond films are, you know, they're their own thing. You know, you have one, and the next one should be very different or kind of different. You know what I mean? I don't like the idea of I like the idea of jumping and just like Bond just hops from wonderful, incredible adventures from one to the other. That I think the film should be like that, you know?
I mean,
that's why the franchise has been around for 50 years since
because that's why it's still working.
Exactly. Yeah. And the Broccolis have been smart enough. Say what you will about how tight-ass they are, which I think it's obvious they are, but that doesn't matter. They're sticking to a formula that their dad started, and it's worked! And who wouldn't?
The fascinating thing about this for me is the idea that they could come up with a story that is so big that it can't be contained by one film. There has always been a tradition. At the end credits, it always says James Bond will return, but it hasn't been since Octopussy? honestly that we've had a film which said James Bond will return in and then the title of the next film. I would love it if they actually had this so mapped out that at the end of Bond 24 or Bond 4, as Jamie calls it, it will actually say James Bond will return in and then we'll have the title of the film. And even they might say James Bond will return next summer in, because it would be great if they could actually return to a summer slot for Bond.
I think they will. I've always maintained they are going to come back this summer.
It's been a long time since one of those.
You need it to be a big spy, because we were talking about this as well, what we have been missing. We love The Spy You Loved Me. Robert especially adores that film. And we were talking about, when was the last time you had a movie where, in the climax, Bond was backed up by an army of guys, and they all saved the world together? It's been since The Living Daylights, when he teamed up with the Afghan resistance. Yeah, that's called a film that doesn't age well. But anyway, he did that, and, you know, I would love that why not? You don't have to have, obviously, a hollowed-out volcano or the innards of a supertanker, but have a big set and have Bond and an army fighting for 30 minutes. Awesome! You can afford it.
Yeah, it's like that moment in Dark Knight Rises, where he actually has the Gotham City Police Department with him on the streets. You know, that you want to have something like that happen. You want to have Bond become, I don't know, it just brings it into that realm of being something epic, you know.
And by the way, that final scene in Dark Knight Rises, it would have been so much better if it had Bond 77 as the theme music. That would have been fucking awesome. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, you can do that these days. You can just edit that with the, once it comes out on DVD or Blu-ray, grab it, put the music in, put it on YouTube.
Just give me half a chance there.
Actually, my thing is also, if we're going to stick with Craig for two more movies, I would like to see if they, and again, I'm not asking Phil for spoilers here. I'm normally not a spoiler bitch on this, but I would like to see if they do go with a two-part film, if they acknowledge that he's getting older. That, you know, because that's
which is
that
something they've never done,
and that's one of the reasons why Roger Moore got laughed off the screen, is because they basically wouldn't acknowledge that, dude, you're almost 60. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have gotten away with it if you acknowledged it. Say what you will about Indiana Jones 4 and how that movie didn't work. The best thing they did about it was they told you up front, he's older, and that's why you accepted it.
Added to all the complexity of whatever's happening, you know, in the wonderful world of international espionage, but, you know, the character element of, can I still do this, you know?
That's something that Dark Knight Rises did. Dark Knight Rises addressed it. And granted, he wasn't older. He's like 38 when the movie ends. And, you know, they pretty much leave it open. It's like, well, he could be Batman again, .. But, I mean, he's not going to be. But, you know, I like that they addressed it. I mean, again, that's how you get an audience to connect to a character, is by their mortality. Right. You see them bleed. You see them hurt. And then you see them heal.
I always thought that in The World... Was it The World Is Not Enough? No, the one with Madonna and Jinx.
Die Another Day.
Die Another Day. I hated that movie, but the only thing that really worked for me was the opening of the movie when they break him. They fucking break him, and they really destroy him, and you go, see that? I'd never seen him like that. You know, when he's, you know, trapped and he's destroyed, you go, see, that's a great starting point. Then, after that, it goes to...
I'm checking out.
To the crapper. But, you know, I mean, they never do those kinds of things. They did it really well in Casino Royale, you know, after he gets his testicles destroyed into little pieces. but, you know, I mean, those kinds of moments are great because they're character moments. They add, I don't know, they add a layer that usually isn't there in a Bond movie. And I'm not complaining. I love the Bond movies the way they've been. But if you can elevate it a little bit, and, you know, I think that'd be great. But why not do that now?
Well, the other thing that I was thinking about in retrospective was that, obviously, with Connery's films, you had Spectre as an overarching villain, but the big problem that you had was that they shot the books out of sequence, so you had a real problem when it came to the continuity of Blofeld, and not just that you had a different actor each time. So there was never going to be any sweet payoff, and Diamonds Are Forever was such a letdown for me because it wasn't the grand finale it should have been. And I just think that, you know, if they could have, in, you know, if you're making those movies today, you'd be able to sort that out. You'd lock an actor, you know, for a multiple picture deal if that's how you were going to play it. You might even shoot the films back to back, but you'd make sure that the continuity stuck. So if I'm right and they are going to bring back Quantum for the next two films, you're going to have their version of a Blofeld, and you're going to have him, you know, for several films. I mean, you've
They legally own Blofeld now. They got that back from McGlory now that he's passed, so they can do it if they want to.
And there were legal issues with that a long time ago, that's right.
But I can guarantee you, if they do bring back Blofeld, and all three of us here know this, including you listeners out there watching the show and listening, he will not look like the old Blofeld because of Dr. Evil. There's no way they'll do that. They'll go back to the old
Blofeld. You can't do it anymore.
No.
Well, we're going to be on this like a hawk, I can promise you. It's going to be a long wait, and I certainly hope that they don't rush them, whatever they're going to do. But whatever they're going to do, it sounds if they're...
I think they're
going
to.
I don't know.
They're going to.
Well, yeah. I know that, I mean, the only comforting thing about it is that Craig's available. Like, you know, he's not doing Golden Compass sequels, and he's not doing The Girl That Played With Fire, or whatever it's
certainly
called.
Certainly not doing more cowboys versus more aliens.
We have to remember here also that there was a point where if Skyfall had been delayed another year, he would have been gone. He was going to be out.
Yeah.
So no, I think
they're really going to take advantage of what they had, especially if this one turned out as well as you're saying, Phil, and they're going to take advantage of it, especially because they have the whole thing with the rights for a while, and they thought they were going to make another one for and God knows how long. You know, now that they have it, they're going to do it.
Before we get into anything else, congratulations on the release of season one of Next Gen. Before, when we were talking, it was still several months away, I think, and we were desperately waiting for it. Now, I take it sales figures have been suitably met and exceeded.
Yeah, everything's been great. The sales have been very good. The reviews have been amazing. That's the greatest part of the whole thing, to, you know, release this and give it back to an audience, and an audience that cares about it deeply and is very vocal, and to kind of get their blessings and have them and see that they are happy with the product. That's pretty amazing. And then we also had a very unique thing. We had a theatrical event, in the US, Canada, I think we had it in London as well, and Australia and a bunch of other territories, where we played two episodes from the remastered Blu-ray versions, and, you know, some of the special features, played it all on the big screen one night only in a couple thousand theaters worldwide simultaneously, I mean, on the same day. And that was amazing. Most of the theaters were sold out. I mean, it was just mind-blowing to have the show that 25 years ago was, you know, syndicated science fiction drama, had pretty much everything going against it. You had an audience that was ready to bash it and destroy it, because how dare you do Star Trek again without the original guys? And it did incredibly well. And then 25 years later, it gets a life on its own, and you see it on the big screen. You're like, how does this happen? It's really amazing. So it's been great, and we are kind of recreating the same strategy for season two with a really, really jam-packed set with a lot of bonus features. We've done another feature-length documentary, like Stardate Revisited, which was the centerpiece of season one, and we have another one for season two. Again, everyone's back, the entire cast. We were able to get Diana Muldaur for the first time ever. She was, you know, she was only on the show during the second season. So we got her for a very, very candid, unique interview. She never really did any of these before, so it's the first time we have her. We have commentary tracks for this one. First time ever we're doing TNG commentary tracks. We have the historic and epic and mind-blowing cast reunion that Rob and I got to produce and film with all the original cast members on the show, which is amazing. It's like a one-hour network TV primetime special, and the only way to see it is on the Blu-ray set. So that's pretty amazing. And for the first time ever in the history of Star Trek, an extended version of an episode. The Measure of a Man, one of the classics of the show, in which Data basically has to go on trial, and Starfleet will determine whether he is to be treated as a human or whether he is the property of the fleet. You know, a really great episode. We have about 13 minutes of new footage built into the episode, new sound mix, fully restored, new effects elements that were never even completed for the broadcast version because the scenes were cut out. So that's pretty amazing. First time ever that happens, and we're going to show that in theaters, along with Q-Who, the first appearance of the Borg. So it's an insane amount of stuff we've put together for this release coming up in December. So I'm thrilled. I think, you know, what I kept telling Rob and the whole team at CBS was that when season one came out, we're like, you know, we have to keep, you know, topping ourselves with each new season, and we've been able to, so that's really satisfying. And I think based on the reaction that fans had from season one, they're going to be really blown away with this one.
And is there any, I'm just curious, is there any particular thing that, like, that's made your jaw drop as just a fan working on this, like in terms of lost footage and stuff, like, oh my God, I can't believe we found that.
Yeah, the Measure of a Man was really amazing because we had a, you know, we had a VHS tape that Melinda Snodgrass, who wrote the episode, kept from the early days of the editing of the show. When you do a TV show, you know, the editor's first cut usually comes in a little longer than what you're going to be able to broadcast. So, you know, the producers have to sit down and trim it down and create the final broadcast version. Melinda, thanks to Mike Okuda, who is one of the big, contributors to the legacy of Star Trek. He's been on the show since Next Generation, worked on all the spin-offs, was one of the early art department staffers on the show. He was able to get this VHS tape, and we looked at it, and it was a longer version. So at first everyone's like, well, let's just put it on the Blu-ray as, you know, as the VHS thing, like a bonus feature, like here's a look at what might have been, you know? And then Rob and I started pestering our executives. We started going, well, technically, the footage should be in the same, you know, in the same cans as the, you know, the stuff we used to rebuild the actual episode. So why not try and find it? And so they looked for it. And I think 2 weeks after that, they had the footage. And, you know, now we're able to present an extended cut of an episode. This has never done, no one has done this before with a Star Trek show. So, and there's great character. It's not like it's just crappy little moments. It's like really good character stuff that has been found. So that's been a highlight. You know, on season one, when we found all the makeup tests, all the camera tests, all the screen tests for the actors, that was really mind-blowing because, you know, it's the first time these guys are stepping into these roles, and you can see that they don't quite have it all figured out yet, you know. Like, you see how many different contact lenses they tried on Marina, and you're like, and Data, you see, like, bubblegum pink on him, you know, Battleship Gray, and you're like, really, that's what they were thinking of? But so that, to as a fan, that's really awesome, you know, those kinds of things. And there's way more to come. I mean, there's still all these cans that are going to be sorted through for later seasons, so God only knows what we'll be able to find.
And the power of it, I was finding going through season one, is that obviously you have the ability with the restoration and with the presentation that you guys are doing to make great episodes even better. But also, let's be honest, as with any show that lasted seven seasons, there's going to be a few wonky episodes. And for some reason on this set, the restoration and the presentation you guys did, it had the ability to make wonky episodes just immensely watchable. There's one particular episode, and I've emailed Roger about this, which is basically, it's a guilty pleasure, basically, because there's this episode where they land on a planet of Swedes, basically. They're all muscular, blonde-haired men and women, and they live in a world of absolute tranquility and loveliness.
That's justice.
Free love.
The most racist episode in the history of Star Trek.
I wasn't one to talk about that one.
I think you guys didn't even get to see it, because if I'm not mistaken, the BBC banned that episode when it first aired. So.
You might be right about that. The only thing I remember there being a problem was the one with the creatures and that guy who gets shot in the head and explodes.
Seriously, that was also season one. Yeah,
which they never showed. I think they showed it once maybe, but they never showed it again.
It never made it into when they stripped the show for syndication weekly, you know, they removed it from the lineup of episodes.
I'd certainly never seen it before. I'd seen pictures of the scene in question, but until YouTube, I'd never seen it. But, watching that guy explode in high def was certainly wonderful. But,
it actually looks pretty awesome because it's stop motion, but it looks so cool, you know, because, you know, there's a great craft behind it to be able to do that with stop motion back in the 80s. So it holds up really nicely, actually. Conspiracy is one of my favorite from season one, just because of the odd nature of that episode. And it sets up all these things that you go, yeah, I could see that happening. I would love to have this conspiracy thing of Starfleet and going back and revisiting that. Unfortunately, they never did it again. But so it becomes this unique one-off episode in the whole canon of Next Generation.
But I remember that also... the treats that you find if you really pay attention to the set. For example, when I got the discs for the first time, I just pressed the play all button, as you do. What I didn't know initially is that if you go to select an episode, you even get, you guys even threw in the original TV trails, like next time on Star Trek, the next generation.
And did you see how, did you see how the documentary ends with one of those? Next time on Star Trek, the next generation, and then you cut to the whole thing of Gates not coming back for season two, and then it's
So I took that, which is my follow-up question. I take it that as well as interviewing Diana Mulder for why she was in season two, there will be some earnestness and frankness about why Gates wasn't.
Oh yeah, the feature-length documentary part two, because as you know, we kind of do them in parts on every disc. Part two opens with Gates, and she's very blunt and very specific about it. She says what happened, you know, and Patrick addresses the situation. The other cast members address the situation, and then you have Diana come in and tell, she tells her story. So, oh yeah, we didn't shy away from it, you know. And again, it's been 25 years later. It's, you know, time has passed, and everyone has experienced all these other things, and she got to come back, and so she was very open about it, and that's all there. So it's, yeah, I'm amazed that, that we just keep getting all these people to just be so honest with us and, you know, delve into this history of making the show, because we all think, everyone thinks they know everything about Star Trek because so much has been written, so much has been said, so many conventions have taken place. But the fact that we're still finding stuff and getting people to tell stories that haven't been heard before, that to me, that's like such a great thing. I mean, I don't think I would be as excited about this project if what we were doing, you know, if the supplemental stuff wasn't as exciting as seeing the episodes in beautiful high def, you know, like you have to. It should be, the whole package has to be just mind-blowing, and I think we've been able to do that.
Ah, yeah.
So it's safe to say that you have the greatest job in the world.
I think so. I think so. You know, I don't even think of this as a job. It's just kind of, I mean, it's my life. It's something I love, and I show up and do it 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And
but you don't think of it that way. It's like, it doesn't matter that it's been 18 hours. It's like, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. That's why we go the extra mile, and we really push ourselves, because we know we've been given something very unique and special, and something that, look, to be honest, a lot of people would love to be in this position and be doing this. I just happen to be the schmuck who ended up getting the opportunity, so I'm not gonna not do my best, you know.
There was a special feature that I remember you telling us about last time, Roger, and I don't know if you've been able to go ahead with it, but it was a feature we were talking about called the Writer's Room.
Oh yeah, we filmed it. We filmed it already.
Dude, fantastic! Tell us about that.
It's a reunion of the key writing staff from the show. You know, initially the first 2 to 3 years, it was a bit of a revolving door when it came to the writers. You know, Gene felt he wasn't finding the right people, or he was rewriting scripts and writers were quitting. So it wasn't really until season three when Michael Piller came along, and Michael pretty much gave Star Trek its second wind. I honestly don't think that the Star Trek franchise would be as secure and strong as it's been if it hadn't been for Michael coming in and just really figuring out that, you know, yes, there's, you know, Starfleet people are perfect and they don't quarrel amongst each other. But Michael figured out that all these episodes, rather than being about the external forces, have to be about our people reacting to these things. Season one and two are very much about these gimmick kind of science fiction concepts or things that have really nothing to do with who these people are. And Michael changed that around. You can see that in Best of Both Worlds, although it's about the Borg, it's really about the loss of the captain and the crew reacting to that, you know. So Michael really found the tone and the voice of the show, and then built a writing staff. For the first time ever, there was a writing staff that was coming into a room every day and working. And it was all these young guys, Ron Moore, who went on to create Galactica, you know, the new version, which is so great and popular. Brandon Braga, who went on to, you know, do all these other spin-offs as well. And he just did Threshold, and he was on 24. So another really great writer, Rene Echevarria, who went on to Dark Angel and a bunch of other shows, was also just on Terra Nova. And Naren Shankar, who went on to do CSI for God only knows how many years that thing has been going. So these key guys that Michael Piller kind of nurtured and put into place, we brought them all back together for a really cool piece called Inside the Writer's Room. And Seth MacFarlane is the host of the piece, so that's pretty amazing that Seth hosted it, and he's such a big Star Trek Next Gen fan that he came in there with, you know, had a full notebook full of notes and things he wanted to discuss, and he was even like the writers couldn't even remember stuff they wrote, and Seth would remember it. He'd be like, no, but on this episode you did this and you did that. And Ron and Brandon are looking at each other like, and which episode was that? You know? So it was great to have such an enthusiastic host and obviously someone who's so, popular right now. I mean, he just had one of the highest grossing films of the year and he's hosting the Academy Awards and, yeah, so he's been a really good friend to this whole process. He's been very supportive and he's come in for interviews. He's hosted this thing. We're probably going to get him back for a couple of other things. So it's been really awesome. So that piece is already in the can, as we say. So we filmed it already.
Now we might get back to Star Trek if we've got the time, but of course the other thing we need to talk about, and which was one of the big reasons why you were with us last time, Roger, is Captain Power. Now, yes. Last time there was you had a gag order on you, didn't you? You couldn't tell us much of anything, but since then we've got a title, which is Phoenix Rising. Now, how close are you to actually getting the show to air as we speak?
We just have one, we need one financial element to come into place and then we can make this show. And it's really far advanced. I mean, it's at the network already. It's going through the whole programming thing. It's that we have our international co-producing and distribution partner in place already. So the show, when we make it, will be distributed worldwide because we have a major distributor on board for international. We have a writing staff. We have the script for the pilot is done. Like I said, it's already at the network. It's going through programming right now. We have a great Bible. We have the first 13 episodes of the show. Pretty much we want to do a 13 episode season to start off. And we have it all laid out. We have all the story points. We've been designing stuff. We have some amazing designs. I'm thrilled. I mean, I'm really thrilled with the script. I've been very lucky that I've worked on a lot of cool stuff that I love, like Star Trek and the Ray Bradbury movies, and like I'm in love with this script. I've never worked on any kind of material that I was so obsessed with and I felt as strongly about it as with this one. This script we have is amazing. It's just, I can't say enough good things about Judy and Garfield Reeve Stevens. They're my favorite writers on the planet. They understand the genre. They know the property really well. They know the old show really well, and they're very, you know, they're reverential to the original, but at the same time they've elevated it and they've kind of made it even more compelling. And you know, there's this whole thing of the if you keep up with all the technology news, the moment of singularity. They're saying by 2045, humans and machine will have been able to find a kind of synergy and be able to communicate with one another, be able to. God only knows what things could happen if this goes through. But so they've used this very real hypothesis that all the great scientific minds have right now as the jumping off point for this new version of Captain Power, and it makes it far more compelling, far more believable, and ways, you know, scarier than the original. So I'm really in love with them and the script and the fact that, you know, Gary Goddard, who created the original, is the executive producer. He's been shepherding this with us, and we've been able to just get his great ideas and bring that fresh perspective that Judy and Gar have, and then my perspective as someone who's done science fiction for a couple of years and a fan of the original. And I think between all of us, we've crafted something that we're all really pleased with. And again, it's just been getting really great reactions. You never move this quickly in terms of developing a show and getting it through the through all these stages that it has to go through. We've pulled this off in less than a year. Mm. So that's really impressive when you think about it, you know.
It also fills me with a lot of confidence. If you stall, if it stagnates, there's the possibility of overthinking things or people getting cold feet or things falling through. So I take it the speed of which you've been able to do it gives you a lot of confidence that it is going to be exactly as it is on the page right now, and possibly more once you get the other episodes written.
Yeah, we have so many great people on board. It's just it's amazing, and the look of it is mind blowing. You know, like I stare at these designs in our office wall every day, and they, you know, we get more every couple of days, and I'm like, if we are able to get this on the screen, this is going to blow people away, because it's, like I said, it's very reverential to the original and to everything that's come before. but we've taken a completely different approach, and even the design perspective has been driven by that. We're like, what is our story? What is the concept? How is this different than the old one? And every decision, every visual decision has been dictated by that. So I'm blown away by the new power suits. Because we've all seen in the last 25 years since the original went off the air, you know, everyone has tackled this whole concept. You had the Borg on Next Generation. You had Iron Man now on film. You had video games like Halo. You know, you have all these things that deal with the idea of a mechanized kind of power suit, you know.
You can even say Power Rangers. They have power suits and they transform and all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, that's kind of different because their suits, you can tell, are made out of cloth.
Yes, that's true.
Whereas with Iron Man, you can tell that is a powerful mechanical thing. Same with the Halo games, you know. So much has been done in that realm that you go, how do you even reinvent the wheel? And the way to do it is conceptually. We've figured out a science and a systematic way of for these things to exist, and like I said, every design decision has been based on that, and I'm thrilled. Like I'm not kidding. I stare at these images throughout the day, and I just forget that I'm working on it, and I just get lost in them, you know. So, and we had some great people working on the art stuff. Leading the whole thing is Stefan Martinera, who is an amazing conceptual artist, and his stuff just keeps blowing us away every time we get a new piece of art. So we're building the maquette right now of the power suit. We're building the miniature of it. So we're going to have a full version that we can look at from every angle and study it. So we've been very specific about how to design this whole thing. Gary, you know, Gary's background his background is in everything. Gary's done everything from Broadway shows to film, to television, to theater, to theme park, but he's great at design. His forte is the art direction and the design of things. So, with a guy like him, we're getting amazing stuff, you know, and it is his baby. He created the original, so there's no one better to figure out how these things are going to look if you're going to reinvent them, you know.
Well, another thing which is still so far off, I mean, I am marking down the days and I don't even know when it's coming out, and we're going to pester you about it again, Roger, and you're going to slap me again, but when is Toy Masters coming out?
Well, you know, it played already in Canada.
Yes.
Fantasia Fest. I was there with Rob, with Charlie was there with his film, Crave. Crave also played. So we played in front of an audience, and that's always very eye-opening. The first time you put a film in front of an audience is really helpful because you know what works, you know what maybe doesn't really work that well, you know what was great about it, so you want to add more of that, you know where you need to fill in the blanks, you know. So now what we're doing now is we're doing a pass on the editing from beginning to end to address those things. And by the way, we had a great screening, don't get me wrong. Film Threat loved it. They gave us a great review. The audience was really into it. We had a Q&A afterwards, and fans were really happy with it. But, you know, from the filmmaking point of view and the technical side of it and the storytelling side of it, you realize that you could still make it better, you know. So that's kind of what we're going to be doing now. We're just going to be fine-tuning and finessing it. And then it's off to final color correction, final mix, and hopefully by the end of the year we can be done with this thing, and it'll be out next year. You know, we have a couple of distributors and companies interested in it already, so it's just, you know, like you've heard me say, it's been a crazy year with so much stuff going on, so and the Star Trek deadlines are set in stone, you know, so you can't change those. Phoenix Rising is also pretty much moving at a very fast speed, so Toy Masters kind of had to take the back seat for a couple of weeks there. So, but you know, we're gonna get it out. We're gonna get it done. And you're gonna love it, Phil, because if you are really into Masters and this whole universe, I mean, speaking about things you find out, like you were asking me what are some of the cool things you found out on Next Gen. Well, on the Toy Masters documentary, there's so much cool stuff that, you know, cause, you know, again, the history behind something like Masters of the Universe, and the mechanics of what happened hasn't been as well documented as something like Star Trek, you know, where with Star Trek during the golden era, you were getting all those behind the scenes books. You had like two or three magazines coming out regularly, you know, Star Trek Communicator, Star Trek, the official magazine. You had countless documentaries, you know, so there's been a lot that has been said about that universe. Having said that, if you've seen the stuff we've done, we've still been able to bring something new to the party. But with Masters, no one had done this. No one had found every single person responsible for this franchise and pretty much put them on camera and have them tell their story and that really compelling angle of how 30 years later they're still fighting for ownership over who created it, who did what. You know, that's that to me, that's pretty fascinating.
I mean, and also another sort of thing, Roger, is that I did get the Masters of the Universe movie Blu-ray this week. It came over, and I just looked at it and wept because of what you told me about what it could have been. I mean, was that the biggest what could have been for you in all your years in this business?
We had an amazing amount of things ready. You know, we were going to get, I mean, look, we're going to get freaking Bryan Singer to moderate, and we're going to get Gary, and we're going to get Frank Langella in, you know, Dolph, you know, we kind of began communicating with Dolph, and he wanted to be involved. So it's ridiculous. It would have been a great, great set, you know. It's heartbreaking. Gary found all his conceptual art, even the stuff that Ralph McQuarrie did, you know. Ralph McQuarrie, who conceptualized the Star Wars.
Yes.
And we were going to release all this, and Warner's just didn't care. Like, no, we don't want to spend any extra money on this. We're just going to put it out the way it is. So that's heartbreaking. It's, to me, it's an insult to the fans, but,
I mean, because it is one of those things that's interesting, as you were saying, how there's very little background material on Masters. Now that I'm thinking about it, most movies, especially movies that we remember like that one, they have B-roll footage, or they have at least a 5-minute making of you could find on YouTube, and that movie, there doesn't seem to be any behind-the-scenes footage made at the time that exists, period.
There was a one day, Gary was telling me that there was a video crew on the set for a day when they were shooting the Grayskull interiors, the whole thing of Skeletor taking over the castle. There was a crew there, video crew there for a day that publicity at Canon Films had set up. And Gary says that he's never seen the footage. He never got it. They probably didn't do anything with it. And, you know, with Canon being such a mess of a studio and this happening as the studio was going under, I think this was probably the last film they released. And they didn't even fully release it. They didn't really get behind it. They kind of dropped the ball on the theatrical release. They didn't do anything with that, and God only knows where that footage ended up. I mean, it's a crime, because it would have been great to see a little bit of that, but we can't even figure out where any of that would be. Everything we have kind of came from Gary, the stuff he salvaged, you know, the production documents, the photographs, the negatives, the things like that he salvaged himself. That's what we had, you know, and Bill Stout kept a lot of stuff too, the production designer, so we had access to all that. I have all that in my office. And unfortunately fans won't be able to see it on the Blu-ray, but you know, we have a plan B, and it's a book that we're going to make.
Nice.
So you'll probably hear more about that soon, but yeah, we've started discussions to get a book made, an art book, you know, on all this stuff, because Gary owns all the art. So we have it. It's not like we have to go to Mattel to do it. So
Roger, given the reaction we've gotten out of Robert the last time we had him on the show, I can't resist. I have to ask you, first of all, what is it like living, well, not living, but working with Robert and his loathing of Star Trek as a film series at the moment? And what do you think of the title Into Darkness?
Well, I've learned to tune him out when he goes into the movie rants, because I've heard him so many times now. But every time someone new joins in or shows up, you know, who hasn't been with us over the last couple of years and you know, and experienced the Rob Burnett rage against the Star Trek movie, every time someone else comes in, he goes into it yet again, and I just have to leave the room. I'm like, I've heard this so many times, and look, I agree with a lot of it. You know, my Star Trek movies are the Kirk movies, and you know, I love Wrath of Khan. You know, I love The Undiscovered Country. Those are more my Star Trek movies. But yeah, he's very passionate about it. I got to tell you, everywhere we go, you know, whether it's at CBS, whether it's at a restaurant, whether it's in our edit bay, in our office building, anytime he gets the opportunity, he will go off on this. So.
And you know, you have to give him a lot of credit, to be fair, because he's basically going off on a very successful, very popular movie, and that takes.
Yes, absolutely. That's the thing. Everyone goes, well, we actually like the movie, and he's like, "Damn it!" You know, and then he goes, Because everyone, here's the thing. Look, that movie, I'll give JJ this. That movie turned a bunch of people who didn't know anything about Star Trek, didn't care anything about Star Trek, made them go into a theater and experience this universe. I will give JJ that. That was very successful. I had, you know, my girlfriend at the time who was completely, she didn't like science fiction. She was, you know, Star Trek did not register for her. You know, it was not a part of her language, you know. And she went with us to go see it. I mean, she loved it. She was blown away by it. Her friends loved it, you know. And you go, well, I mean, that's pretty cool, you know. And then after that, by the way, she started watching Next Gen. We watched DS9, you know. So that's great that someone saw that movie and then went, well, this Star Trek thing is kind of cool, you know. Let me see the other ones. And then she discovered the old shows. Same with Rob. I don't know if Rob told you that, but his little nephew saw the JJ movie, I think. And then Rob gave him the DVDs of TOS, and then he watched TOS, you know. So to me, that's the power that a movie like that has, that it can introduce people to the canon, to the universe. And that's great. That's great, because certainly, look, we love this world. We want more people to experience it. Even if we are not a big fan of the new movie, it's been able to make people who would never have seen Star Trek sit down and watch the old stuff. So I think that's cool. I hate the new title, by the way. Star Trek Into Darkness, that's not Star Trek at all. And what does that mean? And I mean, it's so wrong on so many levels that, yeah, I'm not a fan of it. But again,
you just think of bad trailer voice. That's who you think of when you think of that title.
Mm-hmm. Star Trek Into Darkness.
You can't take that seriously.
Well, because it's one of those things where you go, who came up with this? I mean, because clearly JJ and his camp, I mean, whether you like what they do or not, they're smart guys, you know. You would think someone would say, well, this just sounds awful. I mean, but, you know, I don't know. Look, filmmaking is so difficult. Getting any movie made is one of the most difficult things to orchestrate. Whether you like the movie or you don't like it, it's an incredibly taxing and difficult process, and you know, for anyone to get a movie made, especially a big gigantic movie like that, you got to give them credit for it. So I'll wait for the movie to come out, and then I'll see it, and we'll see what happens. Like, I hate bashing it before it's even come out, is what I'm saying, you know. But yes, that title is horrific.
At this point in a series like that, and with Bond, because trust me, Roger, you're going to find it with Skyfall as well. Not everybody is going to love that film, because...
Have you guys gotten that awesome Blu-ray set that just came out with all the Bond movies?
Oh, yes. Still not finished. Still not finished with it. I've got a few more to go, but absolutely. I mean, that's an interesting thing, Roger, because I can now announce this, folks, is that over the last couple of weeks, myself and Jamie, we have been talking about a few of the Bond films over the last few months. We had, to date, done On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, View to a Kill, and License to Kill. Thank you. We have now, I am delighted to say, done pieces for all of them. All the official original 20, from Dr. No to Die Another Day. And we are going to be putting up that Ultimate Bond retrospective next week. I'm not backing out of it now. It's got to go up in time for you guys to see Skyfall. They're all going to be up. It's roughly 20-minute discussions on each one. If you've enjoyed the ones in the past, you're going to love these ones. It's killed me getting them done for you, but I do it out of love. And we might even have more to do. We might even do all 65 episodes of James Bond Jr. if we're in the mood.
Oh, my God, really? I forgot about that.
Hadn't you just? He reminded me, Jamie, the last week, so it's his fault.
But I can't believe you forgot about that as a Bond
James Bond Jr., wow. Is that even out on DVD? Is that out on DVD?
I'm counting on you to make it happen, Roger.
All right, give me a couple of years. wow. Yeah, no, I totally forgot about that. That's right.
Remember with Dr. No and Jaws, and who else is in that?
Goldfinger was in it, yeah.
Odd Jobs in it.
Was there a Jaws action figure?
There was. And Goldfinger had a daughter called, get this, Goldie Finger.
Wow.
Yes.
Of course, that movie, that show never, of course, answered the ultimate question is like, Bond had a sibling? How was this guy your uncle?
And why did he never turn up? That's
yeah, I know.
The thing that would have made the show work is if you hyped it up and said, eventually, like the last episode, he actually shows up. Even if it's just his hand or something, it would have been nice.
Well, they would have done it. It would have been like the worst Sean Connery impersonation, because that's who they would have gone with, obviously.
Clearly, yeah. Sean Connery wouldn't have touched that with a 10-foot pole.
Well, in the meantime, folks, until next week when Jamie gets to brag about having seen Wreck-It Ralph, you lucky bastard, we'll be right back. Roger, thank you so much for your time, sir. This was amazing.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to chat with you guys, so I will do my best to be back for Bond in 2 weeks.
Best of luck also with Phoenix Rising. I want it. I want it. I wish you every luck. I know it's going to happen, sir.
Thanks, man. I'd love to come back regularly and update you on that, because I am thrilled. Of all the great things I'm doing, that's the one that just really is mind-boggling to me right now. I'm like, really? Are we really doing this? This is amazing.
Well, we'll be back same Movie Moan time, same Movie Moan channel next week. Until then, the balcony is closed.